I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. As cities look for sources of competitive advantage and distinctiveness, they are increasingly turning to arts and culture. Our guests today are involved in two versions of that story. John Podmajerski is a Chicago real estate developer whose family-owned company has created the Chicago Arts District. John and his family have built an exciting collection of galleries and working artist studios, and we'll find out how he did it today on Smart City. Also with us is Terry Nichols Clark, who, with his colleagues at the University of Chicago, is documenting America's culture in extraordinary detail in an attempt to find meaning in each city's cultural scenes. He's the author of The City as an Entertainment Machine. We'll talk about the potential for arts and culture to change a city today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. John Podmajerski is the third generation of his family dedicated to building the Chicago Arts District as an exciting new urban community in a collection of mostly older buildings. Since 1914, the Podmajerski family has been living in the East Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, working toward that goal as real estate developers, creating a living and working environment anchored by arts and culture. John, what sparked your family's interest in what is now called Pilsen East along Halsted, just south and west of the Chicago Loop?
Well, I think they were on the very early friends and family program, meaning they came after other friends and family from Slovakia to Chicago and to this neighborhood, which was already established as a port of entry for Eastern European people. The early version of the family business was a dairy. My grandfather came for 4 years, worked, bought a dairy called the Hinckley Dairy, and they delivered milk from about 1918 through the early 40s via a dozen Clydesdale-drawn carriages. Anyway, so what happened then is that the dairy business changed. They needed to invest in equipment and distribution and things that they, for whatever reason, didn't want to do. The neighborhood had fallen into a lot of disrepair after the Depression. Real estate was sort of a natural thing for them. They loved the community. They loved the sense of family, and they wanted to kind of retain that. So they started buying buildings and fixing them up. And a lot of the early people working in the buildings were friends and family. And a lot of the people living in the apartments, I think, were extended family and friends, people who worked in the dairy who needed the help. So that's how the real estate thing got going. There was a tremendous amount of, you know, abandoned property at the time. And so creating the beginnings of the assembly of the property was, an easier thing than in the sense that you could buy buildings sequentially. And, you know, so we got this foothold going. My father, who, you know, didn't initially want to be, you know, working in the business, which was a common theme, eventually he came back after his father had a heart attack in the late 50s. And, you know, my father then started developing his own vision for the neighborhood and buying properties and helping his parents run their properties. And then subsequently, myself, I bought my first property in the neighborhood in about 1987, April Fool's Day 1987, as a matter of fact. And, you know, I'm carrying on in that fine tradition.
When your father and your grandfather entered the business, started buying buildings, do you think they imagined themselves as developers?
Oh, no, definitely not. And I think we're just starting to get into that mindset because we have a lot of property now and we get treated like developers, even though I don't know that any of us really think of ourselves that way.
And what does that mean, you get treated like developers?
People want us to donate a lot of money to things. You know, the various municipalities want to treat us as though we're, you know, a huge construction and development company. And we're subject, by virtue of how much we've got going there, we're subject to a certain regulations and expectations that, you know, we have to live up to. And
yeah. Tell me about your father and your grandfather's original vision for the neighborhood. Was there a vision that extended beyond, let's buy these buildings and fix them up?
I don't know about my grandfather so much. He was an inventor. You know, I think he was trying to take care of family and stabilize out, you know, the area. My father and my mother together created this vision for the arts community. And it didn't initially start as this vision of an arts community. It started as a vision for revitalization of the neighborhood. When he got back involved, the Dan Ryan Expressway had just come through. And this was and still is a great scar on our big cities in America. It divided a previously robust community into two, cut off all kinds of historic pathways. The demographics then withered both sides. And then, you know, the expressways themselves were like a big vacuum cleaner taking people at that time out to the suburbs. So anyway, he had to come up with a vision that would be something exciting to catalyze growth and stability in the neighborhood. So he was able to assemble the first block of buildings at 18th and Halsted, which we call to this day the Mall. And his first concept really there was sort of a mixed-use retail mall. And I think he wasn't as successful at attracting businesses as he wanted to be. So somebody mentioned the artists from the Art Institute need a place to do things. Why don't you go and talk to the Art Institute? He did, and that's how the ball got rolling. I think there was a natural creative explosion that took on between my father and my mother's minds and their desires and the kind of people they started meeting. My mother was an artist and is a very creative person, and this led my father to kind of start to envision that he could recreate the family nature of the community and this warm community that he had grown up in, but instead of old Slovaks, and you know, it was going to be artists now. And it did become that. It has become that.
You've raised several questions. You mentioned the original vision was for retail, and you substituted, or your father substituted, artists. Now, artists don't pay the same rates as retailers. So financially, how did he make that work?
Well, I think there were no retailers, so they were paying precisely zero. So however affordable he had to make it for the artist to work out, it was better than nothing. I'm sure he wasn't thinking of it, this is better than nothing. I'm sure he got turned on about it, and all of a sudden it just started rolling, and he figured out a way to make it work. Buildings were very inexpensive in those days. Nobody wanted buildings in neighborhoods like that. So the cost of the buildings was more figuring out how to renovate them creatively and economically than the upfront cost of the property.
And, of course, you've been developing there for 20 years.
Almost.
Yeah. Over time, how did you take this notion of artists living in this area? How did you make that into a marketing asset or
Are you asking me about, from when I started getting involved? Or are you talking about from when my father started?
I think both. I'm not sure what the timeline is. So tell me when it began to be noted as an artist community, as an artist neighborhood, and then that had value beyond the artists themselves.
I think that it started to become noticed as an art community concurrent with the start of the annual open house, which was just a couple of weekends ago. This was our 35th, so doing the math back, right around 1970, although I suspect that even in the late 67, 68, 69, there was a lot of activity going on there, and there were things happening. Anyway, so about 67, 68, 69, as we tried to look for ways to sort of have the city know that there was this creative energy going on there, and that didn't just occur. That was a collaboration between the artists who were there at the time and my parents. You know, that wasn't us as real estate developer trying to come up with a scheme to market the property. This was just a genuine, let's collaborate, mutual benefit. Let's get some of our artwork sold. Let's get more excitement about what's going on here. Let's share all this cool stuff that we're all doing with other people.
It was interesting. I went to the art walk, and many of the artists are really young, so you must have a constant turnover, or how does that happen?
There have been a lot of artists and creative entrepreneurs that have come through the neighborhood over the years. We're actually trying to figure out, for our own historical purposes, about how many that's been.
You use the number 1,500.
Yeah, I think that that's sort of a guesstimate based on the number of years and our sort of roughly swag turnover rate. So that could be in the zone. Anyway, I'm a little bit off track. What were you asking?
I was asking about the age of the artist. I was surprised there were so many young artists. I mean, actually living in this neighborhood, having working spaces and gallery spaces in such close proximity. It was really quite amazing.
So obviously we own properties in close proximity, and this is what really makes our community, the Chicago Arts District there, so unique nationwide, is this assembly of properties, which has allowed us to create this densely packed grouping of buildings where artists can be around each other. They're not just in the same neighborhood. They're like within the same grouping of buildings. So that's something that's unique about what we're doing. The youth, over the years, we've seen a lot of artists come to the neighborhood and they use us as a spot to get the ball rolling. And then they go on and they move to other cities and to further develop their work, or they'll buy a place themselves. We've really tried to encourage people over the years to invest in the community because we've always felt that was a good investment. Yes, the neighborhood has a history as a port of entry for immigrants. And I kind of look at young artists and creative people as being a group of immigrants that have been coming into our city for a number of years now. So we're sort of a port of entry for that group of new urban immigrants now. And they tend to be younger, and they, you know, as they get older, they build families. Now, you know, we've had a number of people that have been there for longer than anybody can possibly imagine. We've got numerous tenants that are there more than 30 years. We have our own little contest. I shouldn't say contest. We know who the champion is right now. And some of those folks have raised families in the community, but they've decided to stay on.
The value in those neighborhoods have been built on the strength of their identity as an artist community. Then finally, gentrify, or the values increase so much that artists can no longer afford to live there. And you know that's happened over and over. It doesn't seem to have happened in Pilsen East. How have you've invested many years and a lot of money, I'm sure, in the community. You deserve to make your profit and gain from the value you've created. So how do you look at that as a developer, and where does your payoff come from?
First of all, my vision of the future of the neighborhood is that it is going to be a very high quality and diverse place to live. You know, one of the building blocks and the foundations of that neighborhood is rich culture and rich history and rich design in many manifestations. So we really feel that it's important to ensure that we find a way to retain the creative community in the neighborhood. Now, the neighborhood is going to undergo change. I mean, the pressures that are on other developers are beginning to be on us, real estate taxes and renovation costs for the buildings. So a number of years ago, 3-4 years ago, as I was sitting trying to figure out how do I in fact create a successful model for this to go on in the future, we feel that the future is based on artists being successful as entrepreneurs and not necessarily on inexpensive rent. We're going to do everything we can to keep rents reasonable, of course. I mean, we can't charge more than the market will bear. But we've tried to change the paradigm and have artists there start thinking of this as a place that they can sell more work or be more creative. And that, in turn, will allow them to be more able to deal with the increases in costs that are going to come from a neighborhood like that. So envision that, you know, the future of that neighborhood as this incredibly concentrated spot where people will come to Chicago to be exposed to different mediums of artists to buy artwork for their homes or their collections or their businesses. So we developed this concept of the Chicago Arts District to really start to promote the area and the artists that are there as a location where people can accomplish that task and enjoy beautiful community with these gardens as part of their experience of being there.
Yeah, talk about the gardens. You haven't yet, and for those who have not been able to visit the Chicago Arts District in Pilsen East, tell me about those gardens.
Well, the gardens are former alleys behind these buildings, and they were made possible by the fact that, you know, my father, my grandfather and I were able to assemble, in many cases, whole blocks of buildings, and we were then able to petition the city to vacate the alleys. So the alleys were originally what I'd call a survival tactic because the street scene there in the 60s was really pretty dismal. And my father had to develop a way to create a beautiful environment that would attract people to it, despite what was going out on the street. So in the early days, the buildings were really, in a way, faced inwards to these gorgeous courtyards and gardens. And I think that my parents were sort of inspired in the garden concept. They were in the mid-50s in Europe for their honeymoon. They drove around with my father's mother and father in a minibus for over a month. And they just got to see all these dense, older urban spaces and how people made beauty out of little or nothing in these European cities. And they were very inspired by that and thought that they could bring that to create quality of life in Chicago. So the gardens have been maturing over the years, and with my mother as sort of the steward of that, and they've won a number of competitions, and they've provided this sanctuary-like atmosphere in the middle of this dense urban community that I think is very special and unique, and has been, you know, why a lot of people have come and stayed so long. There's just nothing else like it.
Yeah, they are so charming. Who takes care of them?
We have a landscaping company now that is taking care of them. That's been a relatively recent thing. Throughout history, it's always been, our version of Chauncey the Gardener. There's been some person, there's probably been four or five some persons that have been there 6 or 7 years that had a aptitude for gardening that were sort of in charge of that with my mother. And, you know, they have to leave for whatever reason, and we have to find something else. There's so much garden space now that it really needed more of a squad than a person.
Than a Chauncey Gardener. In your vision of a Chicago Arts District, what's missing from your development, your neighborhood?
What's missing is what we're in the act of really cultivating change in, which is creating a market for artists to be able to readily sell their work in the neighborhood. So we have had this emphasis over the last 3-4 years on bringing the storefronts back to life and cultivating people for the ground floor spaces who were going to establish galleries there and expose their artwork to the world. And it's been really very successful. I mean, we've got over a dozen galleries there now. We've got a lot more people interested. We're starting to see some more established gallery practices and art-related businesses wanting to be in the area. I think there's some other things that are missing there that we're also working on changing. We need some, you know, we need to develop some restaurant service and some other services in the neighborhood that will make the experience of coming there more complete for people, you know, so that they can have lunch or have dinner. We've got another theater now, so now people can come and see a show. Is that what you were wondering about?
And what lessons, John, do you think other cities, other developers who want to use art and culture as a centerpiece for creating value in a neighborhood, what can they learn from your experience, your successes and your failures?
I think that we've done a lot with very little in that community. The power of what my father did in the early days really was long on imagination and hard work and was sort of short on capital. Artists were able to be part of that change. They were able to make a contribution that kind of turning the economic development opportunities for that neighborhood around. Our situation is unique in the sense that we were able to assemble this property and have control over it. So when we act in a powerful way. In many neighborhoods, that's not the case. You've got a lot of different property owners. So I think that the opportunity for developing art community in different neighborhoods might be along the lines of establishing their own version of the Chicago Arts District, where property owners and artists get together and develop some themes to promote the neighborhood and to create permanence and stability for the artists out of those collaborative efforts. I think some of the other things that people can learn is that some of the good old-fashioned principles around which older cities were built, density, and are good, you know, where we feel like that dense assembly of artists there has been good. The gardens and creating quality of life. Boy, there's a lot of development that I see going on right now that meets a market point, but doesn't seem to create what I'd call quality of life. And I think that that's something that we've really done and will do even more powerfully as we go on here with time. That's very important. Create quality life where people want to raise their families and can live healthily and for a long time in a neighborhood where they feel like they lead a rich life in the neighborhood.
Well, your family has created a wonderful neighborhood. John, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
John Podmajerski is a principal in his family's real estate company. The family's focus is the East Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, which they've transformed into the Chicago Arts District. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about disappearing department stores. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Terry Nichols Clark about cultural scenes and the city as an entertainment machine. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, I think you know my new office in Chicago is on the block just north of Marshall Field. So it was a sad day recently in Chicago when we opened the paper and learned that its new owner had decided to change the name.
Yeah, well, Marshall Field's is a special institution in Chicago. It's the largest department store. There are other department stores there, but Marshall Field's is the special one. A lot of cities had very special department stores, and for those of us who feel a little sentimental about cities, we really hate to see those department stores either losing their identity or just simply shutting down in the downtowns and going away. Probably like you, Carol, I remember as a child being taken to downtown to see the decorations at Christmas time and sit on Santa's lap. Here in Atlanta, they had Rich's, which was the giant sentimental department store, and it had a couple of interesting traditions at Christmas. It had, first of all, the city's big Christmas tree. The Christmas tree lighting took place at Rich's department store downtown. And then they had something called the Pink Pig, and it was a very tame roller coaster that little children could get on and ride around the roof of a Rich's department store. And Marshall Field's had that kind of bond with people in Chicago. It is said that if you wanted to make sure that you didn't miss someone in Chicago, you could always tell them to meet me under the Field's clock, which is on State Street. And everybody knew where that was. And so people met there the way that they used to meet in the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria in New York. Field's dates back to the 1860s. It survived the Great Fire of Chicago. It is a genuine piece of history. And what happened to Field's and why it lost its name is pretty much the story of what happened to other city department stores like Rich's, which has also lost its name. They were bought up by big chains, and the biggest is Federated. And Federated Department Stores is consolidating all of its little regional department store chains into one large one, which is called Macy's. So we don't have Rich's in Atlanta anymore. We have Macy's. They don't have Marshall Field's in Chicago anymore. They have Macy's. They don't have Bon Marché in Seattle anymore. They have Macy's. And so on and so forth.
Well, we still have Marshall Field's for a few more months, but, you know, I can really empathize with the marketing department. I was in banking years ago when we bought a lot of banks and had to make that decision to change the name because it was so much more efficient for brand identity and marketing and so forth to have that single name that, you know, rolled across all of your banks. So I get it from an efficiency standpoint and an attempt to build the brand, but it also works against distinctiveness and authenticity, which I think a lot of people are seeking today, and it's harder and harder to find. I think this one was a big mistake.
Yeah, I understand the business logic. I just hate to see these great old institutions changing.
Well, so do I, but I guess, you know, business is always moving and changing, and perhaps something wonderful will arise to take their place. But Marshall Field's actually is pretty great and a great temptation to have it essentially next door to your office. Walking in and out every day, it's pretty tempting. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, Carol.
Thanks. I'm Carol Collette, and you're listening to Smart City. Terry Nichols Clark works on political sociology, social stratification, urban policy, cultural and intellectual institutions. He teaches at the University of Chicago, and he is author of The City as an Entertainment Machine. He's coordinator of the Fiscal Austerity and Urban Innovation Project, an ongoing survey project of 7,000-plus cities in 35 countries. Terry, you've written that old ways of thinking, such as land, labor, capital, and management generate economic development, are too simple, and the developer's classic location, location, location is similarly incomplete. So what is the new way of thinking about economic development?
The way we try to look at it is to suggest that in an earlier phase, those factors were critical. Phase one. Phase two, in a sense, was human capital is also important. The earlier factors don't disappear, but human capital got stressed by people like Gary Becker, an economist, 20, 30 years ago. What we've added here with Ed Glaser, Richard Florida, and others is the focus on urban amenities. What attracts talent, that is human capital, to different cities, to different locations, and makes those places innovative and spark in their economies and in their cultural lives?
This is a huge debate because people really want to make it one or the other. Jobs attract people or amenities attract people. How do you enter into that debate?
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think you phrased it well. It can be phrased as an either or, but for sure it's both. For some people, it may be just one or primarily the other, but most people tend to make decisions where they have some job consideration and some amenity, housing, personal factor consideration in addition to the job, and they join the two. And if you have some degree of choice in the kind of city where you can get a job in the different range of possible options, that is, some persons, those who shop more, who move more, especially the younger, the less engaged with families, singles, the more highly educated, they're more in demand. They can more easily respond to the competing demands, and they can be more easily represented with more choices. But my quick answer is both. For some, it may be more the amenity. For others, it may be more the job.
So how do you define amenities, urban amenities?
We follow the economists who really innovated with a concept as non-market consumption activities. So this is really most everything that government does. And I would even extend it beyond what the economists have done to include aspects of market transactions which go beyond the transaction itself. For instance, a restaurant. Most economists would say engages the individual who's a consumer and buys a meal at the restaurant. I would add that as an urban resident, if you have a broader choice of a range of restaurants, that range provides an urban amenity. And even if you don't go there, or if you go there once every 5 years, the fact that you can, or your neighbors could, or it may make that city more interesting.
That's a very interesting point, because it's one that Richard Florida made in his work that said just the presence of options is an amenity, even
Absolutely.
If no one's using them. And that's very confusing to the marketplace. It's very confusing to a mayor trying to make decisions about providing government amenities. It's hard to justify providing an amenity no one uses, but you would make the case, I take it, that in fact the presence of it, simply providing it, can be a benefit.
Well, if you have 5 million people in a city, even if 4 million don't use it and 1 million do, they may show up at summer dance, at the free festivals on the lakefront. They may, not everyone uses the bicycle paths every day, but there still is a crowd on the Chicago lakefront. So the kinds of amenities we're talking about there have been phenomenally successful in the city of Chicago.
One of the conundrums that a mayor faces and other civic decision makers, those people who go out and raise the money for amenities, is trying to make a decision about which one has more value. Is it the aquarium? Is it the art museum? Is it summer dance or a special event? How does your work inform those kinds of decisions?
That's a very hard, challenging policy question which faces civic leaders, government officials, foundations, and others. I've been going to lots of meetings in the last few years on great topics like fun in Chicago.
Sounds like a fun topic.
Yes. And listening to people from the Department of Cultural Affairs, from parks departments, and so forth. And one intriguing thing which Chicago has done in a different way from some other locations, I've asked the question, for instance, at the end of a long debate about what should we do? Should we spend more on the beaches? Should we do more of this, more of that? I've asked, how much are we waiting tourists, outsiders, visitors, versus local folks, people who live in Chicago? And the consistent answer of people here is, let's build it in a way that Chicagoans like it. And if Chicagoans are engaged and enthusiastic, so will the visitors be too. And that seems to me a very successful recipe for trying to get over the barriers, the definitions of authenticity, theatricality, or things which may not quite fit or be real. And so the way you posed the question, I mean, what form of these might one take is complex. It involves the normal, or it can involve, and it does in many locations involve the city council, hearings, citizens groups, neighborhood groups, petitions, the whole governmental process. And that's fine. That's the way it should be in a democratic context. And my sense is that many locations are providing these very self-consciously and very well, that a number of, for instance, suburban towns have often a very self-conscious identity of who they are and how they're a little bit different from the next location in their schools and the length in which they cut the grass and the kinds of churches they have and so forth. And in the sense that they're small enough and they're similar enough that they try to focus on how in some ways they are different. In a sense, bigger cities and more specifically neighborhoods within big cities are now doing that with more self-consciousness.
Well, you see things I don't see, because I see a lot of cities still copying success in another city. And it contributes to this sameness, this massification going on of culture. And I don't see as much confidence or self-consciousness as you do about choices that cities make. I see a lot of copying of, quote, best practices. And I'm wondering if there's a way for a city, Terry, to get at what will add value here in a unique way or in a special way that increases our difference or our distinctiveness. And I know that you've explored those topics.
Exactly. One concrete example. Zach Taylor's recently done an MA and elaborated these points in contrasting the types of restaurants in different American cities. And he has four kinds of cities. Some locations that just have more or fewer restaurants, more choices or fewer. And then the types of restaurants. And he classifies them basically in terms of being more unique, the highly innovative, specific entrepreneurial chef versus the McDonald's, the Olive Garden, the more franchised, standardized fare. I wouldn't say that one is necessarily right or wrong, that we, the same person, may eat in all of these on different nights of the week, that we don't always want to spend the more money, take the more time, we may be in a rush, in which case people may just have a Big Mac, but on other occasions they may want something much more grand. Similar manner, cities, if they have different neighborhoods, different combinations of these, can ideally have their cake and eat it too. If have the Target, the Walmart, as well as having the highly individualistic location where you can get a customized wedding dress made that matches your wedding style. So with the right combination of entrepreneurship in the private sector with encouragement from government officials, ideally we can do each, although for sure different neighborhoods, different individuals, different cities, different mayors will lean a little more toward the one or toward the other.
In the wake of Hurricane Katrina, there's been a lot of speculation about the ability of New Orleans musicians and artists to reemerge if the cultural milieu that produced them has been wiped out. How do you expect the New Orleans cultural scene to fare?
That's certainly an open, difficult question, but I guess I see the same thing close up in Bronzeville, a near South Side African American where I've lived for decades, and we've had lots and lots of discussions of what's authentic. How can we recreate what we have lost? And we have lost in the near South Side most of the jazz clubs. There were 40, 50, 60 of them in the 1930s and 40s. There are two or three left. And they've moved to the north side of Chicago. They moved to New York. And many of the musicians still have at least a residence in that area, in Bronzeville. But they're on tour in Montreal and Paris and Hong Kong and New York and Hollywood. Their hearts are still there in this area of Chicago, where there is such a rich heritage as there is in New Orleans. So I would say whatever happens to the specific neighborhoods that the New Orleans tradition, the Louis Armstrong, the sense, the feel of that will continue. I don't know just what, it's too early to say, but I guess having not only lived there, having been active in the cultural life, been participating with civic groups, with others, talking about these very issues, there's a terrific vitality. There's a great degree of ingenuity of trying to find ways to adapt to the changes, to loss of jobs, if a club closes down, if someone moves out. clearly that happens, but people who are creative in music are often creative in finding solutions of these organizational sorts as well.
Clearly the presence of many people of color is central to New Orleans' cultural scene. Do you think the presence of large numbers of poor people has also been central to that scene?
Well, certainly the themes in blues are very much related, often to distress, to difficulty, sadness, difficulties in one's life, tragedy. Those are themes in country music as well. There are themes in jazz, which have spread. And that is a major contribution to global culture from lower income, predominantly African American musicians and songwriters. I think it's likely to be there even if they get a little more close to Ella Fitzgerald in there or Oprah Winfrey. Four of the 10 most higher income earning Americans were African American, I read a year or two ago. Oprah, Michael Jordan, Michael Jackson, and Magic Johnson, as I recall. But in the case of at least two of them, you have entertainers who can use their common origins as a continuing theme, even if they individually may have become multimillionaires. So I guess the cultural foundation is there, and people are likely to draw on it. So I guess the hard question is, do you need to be close to poverty to think or to talk or to sing or to compose about poverty? Not necessarily. Is it more authentic if you do? Well, at least outsiders seem to think it is, so that, for instance, talented white jazz musicians can't get jobs in Chicago jazz clubs. They can play in black areas, but not in white areas. They're not seen as authentic by at least the club leaders. So I guess the quick point I would make is that we live in an increasingly multicultural society where there are more and more unusual combinations, that to be black doesn't mean that you have to be poor. To be poor doesn't mean that you have to be sad. To be sad doesn't mean that you're necessarily of a particular orientation. All these are being combined and thrown up in various ways. And there's a sense of coolness, of irony, of talent, which goes with that, and of a certain social and cultural distance, of being able to combine in music and theater things which may have come from Tibetan female monks chanting mixed with electronic music, mixed with African-American drums in ways that none of those in their original context would have envisaged. Nevertheless, this is now continually heard on places like NPR.
You talk about authenticity, and I know that's one of the ways in which you are evaluating cultural scenes. I think this is really new, interesting work that you're doing on looking at cultural scenes and trying to make sense of them.
We came to the term scene following long-term use by music arts folks. We've tried to codify it a bit more to start with some examples such as the Disney Heaven, which is a way of more generally characterizing one effort to move Times Square in New York toward the Disney style, if not with Mickey Mouse per se, having less gangs, less crime, less prostitution in the area, and to have it more kid-friendly and so forth. In contrast to, say, Baudelaire's River Styx, where you have measures of such as tattoo parlors or crime being more seen as a necessary element of that kind of S-C-E-N-E of a scene. So we contrast these multiple scenes and then suggest that if we try to dig deeper, we can find underlying elements such as authenticity, transparency, theatricality, legitimacy of different types, making them more powerful, more charismatic, or more alienating to different subgroups. So when I said Western Europe, the U.S., many leaders around the world are increasingly multicultural, tolerant, distant from a particular single orientation, nevertheless, we have scenes in which they can find a deeper, more powerful, charismatically expressed, and strong version of subtypes. So you can go into a Mexican-American area, have excellent food, hear the music, see the people of that sort, and then move later on to a gay scene, or maybe organized around a bar, and later on in the evening go to a different kind of club. And so a bigger city facilitates migrating across these different scenes, even by the same individual or couple or small crowd, and they become cosmopolitan when they move from scene to scene to scene and carry the imagery or the combination of these in their own minds and actions.
I want to ask you about a concept you brought up earlier. You talked about cool and hip. And there's been so much conversation in the last few years about these terms. I mean, to the point where probably reached a level of absurdity and, you know, with some maybe very uncool people trying to figure out how to make their cities cool. Where does hip, where does cool come from, and is it something you can tackle deliberately?
The governor of Michigan thinks so, I've been working with some, I think there are 1,000 or so Michigan officials who are going to meet to try to talk about these very issues. And so mayors have been essentially almost mandated by the governor to really try to be more cool. But the question is, what does it mean to be cool? My answer would be that there are as many ways to be cool as there are subcultures and types of people in your city, and that what's cool for one mayor or one city is not necessarily cool unless it works with his constituents and his people who are there. And so I applaud the effort, although I'm a little concerned about how you make it work. But I think insofar as migration of people moving to a city is an important factor, as we talked about briefly at the beginning, and insofar as local officials, mayors and council members, civic leaders are concerned to have talented people and all kinds of people move to their city or come as tourists or come as visitors or come as shoppers or come as conventioneers, then making that location have appeal through whether it's called cool or attractive or aesthetically refined or whatever means appealing to those subgroups which can be attracted. So I guess what I'm suggesting is not necessarily to aim for a standardized Walmart or a standardized Big Three TV broadcasting approach, but to look for a market niche, to look and see how you're distinctive and try to do that well, although many municipalities, many mayors will recognize that they may be serving two sets of constituents or four sets of constituents or even more. And insofar as they then try to balance that in their decisions and their policies about parks or the schools or what to have in the local festivals, that ideally should be workable in terms of making the place a cool site for others.
Terry, which cities do you think are using the amenities, cultural, entertainment strategies in a smart way?
I see lots of locations doing it in the sense that if you're a sensitive mayor and you're sensitive to your constituents, whether you're from a big, small, rich, poor location, and if you're doing a good job as a mayor, you're probably doing these things already, which is why you're elected in the first place or reelected. In that sense, I guess I'm disagreeing a little bit from some of my colleagues like Rich Florida, who tends to have more of a sort of a cool, one of his favorite measures is gays, percent gays. And I've critiqued that as saying that's too simple. Yes, that's one sort of characterization. But there are many different ways to be cool in many, especially if you take the whole U.S. And so my examples of Disney Heaven is one extreme. The Baudelaire's River Styx, in a sense, is the opposite sort of imagery. It's closer to the gay model. But some people are turned on by the one and others turned off by the other. And if you're a creative mayor, you need to be responsive to whoever your constituents are. And so that implies basically a multifaceted approach of, and you can solve that by neighborhood. Even if people don't live in a neighborhood, they may be distinctive in their restaurants, in their clubs, in their park, and in the movie theaters nearby. And so having and encouraging, facilitating that through the governmental process, through banks lending and encouraging in this manner. And then to come back to your question, which cities? City of Chicago, I see up close, and so I'm highly aware of some of the very excellent things being done, but I sense they're also really national or international leaders. Just one quick example. The mayor has asked each city department to incorporate some aspect of culture in every department in the city. The police department therefore said, culture? You know, what do? We pass out tickets. So they found some young guys on the west side who invited them to be stand-up comedians in a show. And so the cops stood up. They got lampooned, made fun of by the young Hispanic guys. They took it, and it seemed to resonate well at the end.
How can a mayor or a civic decision maker take those foundational elements of scenes, theatricality, transparency, legitimacy, and authenticity, and understand them and amplify them to make a better city?
I think just talking about them the way we are now reading about them, talking about them, raising them to a little higher level of consciousness is a way that that will happen. And that's happened earlier, say, in terms of being sensitive to civil rights, to women's equality, to gay rights. I mean, when those things have been simply talked about, as well as having the law and the federal government behind them, but simply having articles, thinking, talking in those terms, I sense the same thing is happening now about making cities cool, about using a focus on amenities, on culture, on the arts. These have become very in with many mayors across the country. The blockbuster success of Rich Florida's book is clear testimony that the book is popular, but it's also a relatively sophisticated book. I mean, I would say it's an excellent testimony to the intelligence and the seriousness of American leaders, local leaders across the country, civic groups, that they're reading and thinking and talking seriously with Rich Florida about this level of issue, which is a relatively complex and sophisticated issue compared to spending more or less or higher or lower taxes or paving the streets or something like that.
Terry, it's always great to visit with you. Thanks for being my guest on Smart City.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carol.
Terry Nichols is the author of The City as an Entertainment Machine. You're listening to Smart City. City Views commentator Walker Smith questions comparing IQ scores over time as a means of determining how intelligent we are in society today.
In his new book, Everything Bad is Good for You, science writer Stephen Johnson claims that pop culture is making us smarter. His argument is simple. The video games, TV shows, internet, and movies of today require higher order cognitive skills to enjoy, so they have made our minds sharper and brighter. Alongside the emergence of problem-solving and multi-threading in pop culture, Johnson cites social science research documenting a concurrent rise in IQ scores. Johnson calls this the sleeper curve. Only in the future, he says, will we wake up to realize that what we think is bad today was actually good for us. Johnson's thesis is intriguing and provocative. Certainly, it's worth remembering that denunciations of pop culture almost always turn out to be short-sighted and tone-deaf. Many of the artists and styles that were once regarded as frivolous and insubstantial are now studied as classics of the arts or Americana. It's not clear, though, whether contemporary pop culture has taught us something new or has just tapped into a latent competency we had no reason to use until now. What's worrisome is the reverse snobbery implicit in Johnson's argument, in which the past is portrayed as less sophisticated or dumber than the present. Comparing IQ scores over time is not easy to do. IQ tests have changed. Decades ago, rote learning was emphasized, so IQ was a matter of memory. Nowadays, problem solving is emphasized. So today, IQ is a matter of abstraction. One is not better than the other, except as times demand more of one than the other. It's just that these are different sorts of intelligence. Rather than concluding we've gotten smarter, it seems more accurate to say that compared to the past, we are smarter now about different things. In fact, I think we would be hard-pressed to assert that our general intelligence these days is smarter than the general intelligence that produced the great insights of political philosophy in the 1700s, or the great advances of science in the 1800s, or the great flurry of inventions and innovations that swept the world during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, a time now regarded as the most intensive era of technological change in history. Even so-called primitive cultures engage in highly complex thought. This was a point made repeatedly by the world-renowned French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. In one now famous comparison, Lévi-Strauss noted that while people in modern cultures can do difficult things that primitive people cannot, like drive at high speeds on superhighways, this has nothing to do with innate intelligence. The complexity of mind in primitive cultures is manifested in other ways, such as the kinship structures and cultural taboos studied by Lévi-Strauss. It just seems vain to presume that we are smarter today because we have mastered a different class of problems, characteristic of a different style of pop culture. It is instead that we have the smarts now required to deal with our contemporary challenges, using a type of intelligence that probably would have put us at the bottom of the class in the past. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast. Sign up for our new podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.